This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. In today's program, WikiLeaks rides again with an indexed database of 2 million State Department cables. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange electronically joined a Monday press conference at Washington's National Press Club to announce a new online indexed database of 1.7 million State Department cables that he said were previously obscured from public scrutiny by official tactics of, quote, secrecy and complexity, end quote. Joined by WikiLeaks spokesperson Kristen Robinson, Assange revealed how the new database, called the Public Library of U.S. Diplomacy, is already making news worldwide.
The project that we are introducing this morning is the release of 1.7 million documents from the State Department pertaining to the area of 1973 to 1976. This we are making available to the general public in a searchable database, merging these 1.7 million documents with the already released cables in the CableGate projects, the 251,000 cables. The documents from 1973 to 1976 are from a very turbulent period in our history, and they are casting a light on the U.S. relation and U.S. involvement in many countries, for example, in Latin American dictatorships. So they are of great importance. These documents were all previously classified, but they are now available, but in a very difficult format. It is very hard to search for these documents for academics and journalists, and very hard for the general public. I urge anybody to try to find information there. You have to search in various pockets, and it's very hard to assess them. One form of secrecy is the complexity and the inaccessibility of documents, and it seems to be that the current government is not making a huge effort in making these historical documents accessible. In this way, we are providing a public service. We are doing actually what the government should be doing to make this easily accessible to everybody. Now, there has been also a very serious trend of reversal of declassification, which has been clouded in secrecy as well. In the mid-90s, President Clinton, by an executive order, ordered a declassification of a trove of documents. This was reversed in secret under the Bush administration. It was revealed in 2006 that more than 55,000 documents that had previously been declassified had been reclassified, and this was by the demand of CIA and other agencies. And it was revealed in 2009 that this was an ongoing trend, a very serious one, when the administration tries to hide documents that were previously available. You might be tempted to say that the government cannot be trusted with these documents. So we took the matter in our hands, and we are now making this available in a very accessible database where you can easily search for stories that are of great significance. We are working in this project with 18 media partners that have had some time to assess these documents, and they found stories that they have been publishing, published already, or will publish in the next hours and days. I think it's best that we now connect to London, where Julian Assange is connected via video link. Can you hear us, Julian?
I can hear you, Washington. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you go ahead now?
Orwell famously said that he who controls the present controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. And that is because of the vital role that history plays in deciding our interpretation of what is happening in the world. The US National Archives censored all searches to the word WikiLeaks. Following that revelation, we looked closely at what else was going on. And in fact, as Kristen said, from 2006, it became apparent that the US National Archive had reverse classification of over 55,000 pages of material. That great analysis done by the National Security Archives, a group run out of George Washington University. We have pulled together 2 million documents, 250,000 documents from our previous release, Cablegate, 1.7 million documents pulled from the National Archives, and put them together into an integrated format, a search system that we are very proud of. And I would like to thank our technical team and researchers and donors for putting together this really quite impressive piece of work over the past year. Today, our 18 media partners on this project, we seem to have lost you, Washington. Can you confirm?
Yes, you are on now, again.
Today, the 18 media partners on this project have started to release some of their stories. Now, that is a result of information in some cases being hidden by secrecy, but more often being hidden in the borderline between secrecy and complexity. Already today in India, the ruling party, the Congress party, has been shaken by the revelations that Rajiv Gandhi, part of the Gandhi political dynasty, was involved in what appears to be corrupt Swedish arms deals as a middleman or a broker for family influence within the Indian government. Now, the Congress party has condemned WikiLeaks over that matter, and I say to the Congress party of India that the corruption in the Gandhi political dynasty is well known all over the world, not just as a result of this corrupt Swedish arms deal case, but many other cases. And it's about time that the Congress party of India took its sandals off before entering the corridors of power. In Australia, as Kristen has said, the Australian Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, who is the former Premier of New South Wales, has been revealed to be a US embassy informant, not when he was in the position of politics, but when he was in the Australian Union Movement. And in fact, that was a priority during the 1970s, and in fact, remains a topic of influence within the State Department today, to penetrate unions and co-opt union leaders. In the case of Australia, that includes apparently Bob Carr. In the case of other countries in Latin America, it seems that the stories that we heard from Latin American activists during the 1970s, well, they were more or less true. The way the US tried to corrupt the union movement, the Catholic Church within Latin America. From Spain, the Spanish, well-regarded Spanish journal Publico has found that the King of Spain, King Carlos, conspired with the White House to gain extra influence in Spain, and the United States saw his promotion as an essential element to get NATO to accept Spain, which would help the United States keep their US military bases there. In Brazil, to justify aid to the U.S. military dictatorship, the United States created a torture exemption for Brazil. The Brazilian military had found to be committing acts of torture. United States Congress had put in place a system to prevent aid to torturous dictatorships, but nonetheless, by massaging an exemption loophole, $66 million in credits for purchases of weapons by the military in Brazil was enabled. Of course, if we look at those credit purchasing schemes, it's not about Brazil. It's not about the countries that are buying weapons. Of course, what it's about is tax transfer within the United States from one sector to another sector, namely the sector of people who pay tax, essentially the middle class, to very influential military contractors like Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Raytheon, General Dynamics, etc. In Italy, our partner Expresso and La Repubblica has revealed that just 5 weeks after the coup of Pinochet against the Allende government in Chile, the Vatican was telling the State Department that it had grave concern and the Pope had concern about the way that the international left was describing the coup. So the Vatican was advising the US on how to massage the Allende coup in Chile. Huffington Post Italy out this morning with a diplomatic communication involving a secret agreement between the Communion and Liberation Front over the Communist Party, both parties and the individual concerned, Luigi Giussani, of relevance today in Italian politics. From Egypt, and our Egyptian partner Al Masri Al Yum. This is quite topical and interesting now, that in 1975, the U.S. State Department revealed the use of the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists in the university to break strikes and leftist forces there. So that's quite interesting to see that the Muslim Brotherhood being used as an intermediary device. You normally think of them as an opposition during that period, but being used as an intermediary device to push off and constrain the left in Egypt, which is something that we wouldn't see as a concern today, but it's something that the U.S. State Department was doing all across the world in the 1970s, which was betting on horses, which might look unacceptable, which would nonetheless marginalize leftist movements or independence movements in various countries. So I'll just go very briefly through, if you like, the highlights of the interface. It's sometimes quite hard for journalists and people who work with words to understand the scale of things, because that's something that requires a sense of numeracy. It's why, for example, you see so often newspaper articles confusing 1 billion, 1 million, and 1 trillion, even though we would assume that we would never confuse $1 and $1,000, but that's the degree of scale. But when we can visualize things, we can get a feeling for the scale of what we're looking at. And this material that we've published today is the single most significant geopolitical publication that has ever existed. So here is our world map, and you can have a look at this by going to wikileaks.org/plusd map. The colour code here is a frequency of reference. Now, you can select particular time periods to see the frequency of country references across that time period. Now, as it's not surprising that the Soviet Union is of significant interest, but what is perhaps a little more interesting is to understand the unexpected. So, as an Australian, I know, of course, of the Western and US involvements in Indonesia, but it's perhaps not so widely understood in the United States. You can see that Indonesia here, with more than 140,000 occurrences, is very similar to Egypt. Now, of course, Egypt is of such interest because partly its strategic significance in the Middle East, but also this is the time of the Yom Kippur War and several other confrontations involving Egypt and Syria. Now, if we look at the Soviet Union and compare this approximately 250,000 references to France with 372,000 and the United Kingdom with 376,000, we see something similar to what we saw today, what we see today with North Korea. That is, that there's a desire to hype up, for public relations reasons, the threat of a country. Now, North Korea, these last few weeks, has been chosen to be that threat. And in academic circles, that's known as securitization, where you take some phenomena and you hype it up to instill fear in the community, and you securitize the phenomenon, and that results in increased tax transfer to the military-industrial complex, as opposed to the hospital system or the social security system or even the diplomacy. So we see, actually, everyone thinks about the Cold War and this what is perceived to be a titanic struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union. But we can see, in fact, that the interests of the State Department, as expressed by the content of over a billion words in its diplomatic cables, is essentially checking the activities, interacting with the activities of other empires. And so, yes, the Soviet Union was an attempted empire, but if you look at the true interest, it is of lesser significance during the period 1973 to 1976 than France and, importantly, than the United Kingdom. And that makes sense if we understand the securitization process that we see in relationship, say, to the Soviet Union. Now we can zoom in on some of these regions. And here, for example, is intensity of interest, not measured as by subject, but measured by the actual content of this material in Latin America. And we can see the for this particular time period here, which is just the beginning months of 1973, but it can be adjusted. There's Ecuador, for example, with 1,202 references. The size of these objects is proportionate to the number of references. Similarly, interests surrounding my home country, Australia. Here we can see really quite remarkable occurring in Southeast Asia. Of course, we have all heard about the Vietnam War, but the significance of Thailand, for example, not well understood by the majority of people in historical context. Similarly, the relative poverty of reporting on Beijing and China during this period. But I suppose most significant is this intense interest in what is happening in Indonesia, and Australians and people familiar with this region will remember, of course, what happened in East Timor during this period with the Indonesian invasion. Another way to feel the scale of this material, you can very quickly do a time graph for the entire period for any particular phenomena. So here is, for example, Egypt versus Israel. I'll see if we can add Syria. There we go. So we see here the Yom Kippur War. You'll notice the incidence of spikes coming up all together, reflecting this war. But you also notice the relative intensity of these nations across this period. That yes, Israel is very significant. If we look at some average period, about 2.28% of cables. But Egypt, just under this, really very strategically significant place for the United States. And if we take the days and hours surrounding the beginning of the Yom Kippur War, we can see in the material hourly reporting of what was happening with the reports from the U.S. Embassy in Cairo saying, well, nothing much happening here to promises by the Israelis on and what their intentions were. And then, of course, reporting on the aftermath and the ceasefire. Here's something central to U.S. history, the coincidence between Nixon and Watergate. We can see these spikes here and another one occurring at the time of the impeachment and resignation. Now, some of you may be aware Margaret Thatcher died last night, and of course there are a great many cables about her, some 400 and something, which you can find just by searching for Margaret Thatcher. But here is one that we put out last night ourselves, unaware of what the news would be this morning. Margaret Thatcher, some first impressions. And we see here, unfortunately for her prospects of becoming a national as opposed to distinct from a party leader, she has over the years acquired a distinctively upper middle class personal image. Her immaculate grooming, her imperious manner, her conventional and somewhat forced charm, and above all her plummy voice stamp her as the quintessential suburban matron, and frighteningly English to boot. None of this goes down well with the working class of England, one third of which used to vote Conservative, to say nothing of all classes in the Celtic fringes of this island. That's an example of what happens when you have 2 million documents about geopolitical circumstances all over the world. It's like a source you can interview again and again on nearly any subject that comes up. In this case, what's come up is the death of Margaret Thatcher and no doubt her involvement in the Falkland Islands and so on. Here's a great example from Kissinger himself. There are over 200,000 individual documents referencing Henry Kissinger. This is a meeting between Henry Kissinger and the Turkish foreign minister in 1975, looking at the arms embargo that was placed around Turkey concerning its conflict with Greece and Cyprus. We see here that Turks are concerned about the embargo and they want US weapons parts to come into Turkey. And there's a suggestion that it be sent, and that the Turks say, well, that is illegal. Kissinger's response is a joke, but it's not really a joke, and a fantastic quote. The illegal we do immediately, the unconstitutional takes a little longer, and we'll make a major effort in order to somehow get around The arms embargo, topical today, of course, because of the renewed conflict with Cyprus. Now, this is an interesting example from Sweden involving the Swedish Foreign Minister, Carl Bildt, who has been a bane to this organization, and Karl Rove. So when we first did the analysis of this material, just the first introductory analysis, I did so with a friend who's a Swedish journalist, and we thought, well, let's just pick a random country, something that we both know something about, so let's pick Sweden. And we started going through these Swedish cables, and we saw this name, Carl Bildt, and he's the current foreign minister and the former prime minister of Sweden. And we thought to ourselves, oh, this must be the uncle or the father or something, because this cable is from 1975. It can't be the same guy that's causing us problems now, surely. But it turns out, in fact, it is the same Carl Bildt. The same Swedish foreign minister was inducted into the what the State Department calls his International Visitors Program, given 100,000 Swedish kronas, put in contact with a wide variety of Washington institutions, given his travel details, given to the Central Intelligence Agency, and he passed on extensive political intelligence, which has become a major scandal in Sweden as a result of this release, about inside secret negotiations on the Swedish nuclear policy and whether Sweden would form a government or not. This is a good example of how to use this material journalistically. So we have some raw ingredients here. Carl Bildt going into the United States, becoming a informant to the US Embassy. Once he's over in Washington, developing a personal relationship with Karl Rove. But then we've managed to acquire other documents, and we'll place some of these up later on tonight. And our Swedish partners, Aftonbladet, tracked down Carl Bildt's handler at the US Embassy, who disclosed informant he was. Similarly, Carl Bildt and Bob Carr, the Australian Foreign Minister, were together in Australia on national TV, in fact, talking about our organisation together with the United States ambassador to Australia. And so when you can see this pattern of how people ended up becoming involved in the United States, you can see that they see their patronage network and their networks of influence as intimately involved in currying favour with the US State Department. That IV program is perhaps one of the most significant global stories to come out of this material. It is a global story because there are over 1,000 references to IV grantee, and many of those individuals have subsequently gone on to extremely powerful places. Margaret Thatcher, for instance, is detailed as one of these IV grantees who was taken into the United States, and a number of other figures that are themselves either now in power or they are part of political dynasties. You can search this, the 2 million, 1 billion words through a wide variety of mechanisms. So we've collated all the senders, recipients, internal bureaus within the State Department. It's a search system that I'm quite proud of. One of our people said recently that, you know, that this is what Google should be like, that this is a real search system. This is a search system that investigative journalists can can use effectively. Our Spanish partner, Publico, said this morning that investigative journalism was never so effective. Kristen?
Thank you, Julian. And maybe just before we go over to Q&A, I just want to briefly mention banking blockade that is still in force against us. Just to remind you that in December 2010, shortly after we started releasing the embassy cables and the Cablegate project, in a matter of 48 hours, the Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Bank of America, and Western Union imposed a blockade on us. So ever since, it has not been possible for individuals to donate to us directly. This is still in force. This is unprecedented. Such an attack on an organization that is basically providing information, a journalistic organization. We are fighting this by legal means, and the next milestone in that fight will be a Supreme Court hearing on April 19th. We've had found other means with good support for good people here in the States. The Freedom of the Press Foundation was established, where you can actually donate to WikiLeaks through the Freedom of the Press Foundation. But I think it's best that we go now straight to Q&A.
Thank you very much. Munzer Sulaiman with Al Mayadeen Channel from Beirut, Lebanon. Julian, how easy the search for any document would be in this 1.7 billion document? Can we go by titles, by names, and is that workable? The other thing I want to ask you about about the 1973 war. There is any file related to that? Any new disclosure about that particular war that we can find?
You can search by name, by any text string that you like, and by a great many other parameters. For example, all cables that were sent to the CIA. You can, there's a drop-down menu, it will show you, bang. Similarly, a great many other parameters, which bureau in the State Department was responsible for handling it, categories by concept, categories by particular regions, particular organizations, et cetera, et cetera. It's really quite easy to use and very effective. Our partners, for example, some of, for example, the Hindu, have only had access to this material for 5 days and have already been shaking Indian politics this morning with their revelations about Rajiv Gandhi and an apparently corrupt Swedish fighter jet deal. For 1973, yes, there's a lot of material about the Syrian, Israeli, Egyptian war during this period. Hourly reporting in some cases. Some of it is new in the sense that it hasn't been reported before. Other aspects have been reported before. Other aspects have only been written up in rather obscure academic journals and have not been previously accessible really to journalists in the Middle East.
Good morning, Andrew Blake with RT. I had a question about the documents. Of the 1.7 million documents, like 55,000 pages of them were secretly reclassified during the George W. Bush administration. Is it my understanding those 55,000 pages should not be in the public domain according to the State Department then? Are those 55,000 pages should be left under lock and key? In particular, those ones, as opposed to the rest of the nearly 2 million?
The 55,000 pages were taken from, some were taken from this series of documents, but not from these particular documents. They were taken from other documents in the same building or the same series. That's what we know as of 2006. Now, that reclassification program was secret when it was exposed, it was widely condemned. And statements were put out saying that it would end in 2007. However, minutes of the State Department from 2009, which is the most recent reference we have been able to find, show that secret reclassification program was ongoing. Now, until we do we get another copy of all this material say, in a couple of years, we can't do a comparison to see which material, if any material, has been secretly removed from this over time. But of course, the facts and the precedences are extremely bad for material being held by the National Archives.
Did the organization weigh the release of this project any different than other ones, given that since 2010 the grand jury investigation is ongoing, Bradley Manning's been locked up without trial for over 1,000 days, Jeremy Hammond's been locked up for over 1 year? Did the organization take this into consideration when they were weighing this project, knowing that if these files should be remained secret and the source is compromised, they'll surely be prosecuted to the same extent?
Well, this material is quite complex in terms of its origin. There's the overarching project with 2 million documents has material from a number of sources. The Kissinger cables, in particular, which is the largest body of material, this is being collected from 1.7 million individual PDFs that we reverse engineered. That's essentially what Aaron Schwartz was doing, taking documents which technically should be public, but are placed in a form or kept in some intermediary position between secrecy and complexity that makes them, in practice, not easy enough to use that people who need to understand them can understand them. So if the Department of Justice was to go after us for this release, like they're attempting to prosecute us for previous releases involving US Embassy documents, the approach would probably be along the lines of the approach that was taken with Schwartz, which it is the sort of the manner of acquisition as opposed to the classification of the material.
Yeah, Joe Krause from AFP. I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. These 1.7 million documents, I mean, you're not actually leaking anything new today. I mean, these were technically available in the public domain. You're just kind of collecting them and putting them in a more searchable database. And then I was also wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on what exactly made it difficult to access these documents if they weren't, I mean, if they were technically declassified, what sort of complexity are you talking about? Thanks.
There's a range of material in the 2 million documents, but if we just look at the Kissinger cables, which is the biggest component of that to be released today. They are technically in the public domain, but as you can see with all the news stories that have come out today, they're not practically available to the public in a way that's efficient enough for people to be able to make sense of them or use them. They are in the form of 1.7 million PDF files. So they're not essentially not usable to do sophisticated searches across the lot.
Carolyn Persuti with Voice of America. So to dovetail on Joe's question there, then is your organization evolving from one that, when WikiLeaks first came out, it was the leaking of classified information. Now is it evolving to more of a clearinghouse for journalists, but an organizational clearinghouse?
No, it is a continuation of the work that we've always done. In fact, we have always merged together leaked information and other information to increase the value of both types. A lot of our work actually involves making things searchable, presentable, usable. You know that there's a trick that's used by many departments in the United States to effectively subvert the intent of FOIA legislation, which is to hand out FOIA documents in scanned PDFs with all the colors removed, not searchable, etc., to marginalize the efficiency of journalists and others, but still technically stay within the law.
Hi, I'm Rosie Gray with BuzzFeed. This is also about you, Mr. Assange, but you've been at the Ecuadorian embassy in London for something like 8 or 9 months now, I think. Can you give us a sense of how long you think you'll still be there, what your next steps might be, that kind of thing?
Kristen, perhaps you could answer this in relation to giving a bit of a status update about what's happening with the U.S. prosecution?
Yes, I mean, it's a little bit off topic, but we know, of course, that there is an ongoing investigation into the alleged illegality of WikiLeaks action. It has been revealed by information acquired under the Freedom of Information Act in Australia that Australian diplomats have been told by their State Department officials and officials here in Washington that the scale and scope of the WikiLeaks investigation is unprecedented. A year ago, it was known that the pages of documents gathered in that investigation numbered, 42,135? So it gives you an idea of what kind of persecution is going on and is still ongoing. And it's, of course, it's very worrying. A lot of people have been that have been supporting us, working with us, have been harassed at the borders here at in the U.S. They've been under surveillance. We have confirmation of that, and their information, Twitter accounts, etc., have been subpoenaed. So that is, of course, of a great worry. Yes, we have to have Julian by Skype from the embassy in London. Let's hope that we'll see some progress in the case there, and he will walk free and stand here in this podium in the next press conference we'll have here. But any more questions on the topic?
Hi, Rachel Kurzius with RT America. I was wondering if you could kind of compare the experience of looking at classified documents from the 70s and then looking at kind of new classification systems that have emerged in the 90s and 2000s and say kind of qualitatively what the difference between them is.
Yes, it's extremely interesting. We've put together here, in fact, ways of understanding the internal State Department language. And it really is a language of tags and handling restrictions and so on. And all these vast panoply of acronyms are automatically expanded when you use the WikiLeaks plus the search interface. The period of the 1970s in diplomacy is referred to as the Big Bang. This is when the modern international order came to be. There's really only two periods, which was post-World War II and what happened in the 1970s. You had a period of decolonialization where the number of countries dropped from about 100, increased from about 104 to 160. So that's as a result of decolonialization, the weakening of the British Empire, independence movements, etc. That new situation with having more relatively independent states, not part of an empire which controlled their foreign policy, meant that diplomacy became an essential ingredient to US power across the world. And systems were set up like the GATT, for example, world organizations, world trade bodies. And to understand all that complexity, the US State Department put together a system to harvest intelligence from its diplomats across the world, categorize them into particular tags, put a variety of handling restrictions, for example, no distribution, which means that they just go bang to one person. It's so sensitive, you only want one person reading it, no one else is to read it, to its State Department wide, or to it also goes off to the CIA, also together with handling classifications. Now, back in the 1970s, US embassies were more important. Now, because of the speed of international flights, video conferences like we're having right now, email, etc., means that the center, Washington, has more direct control of the periphery. But back in the 1970s, the relationship between ambassadors and their host governments was more essential, and the mediating role that they played was more essential. So you see, for the same level of classification, a relatively higher degree of important political content. Also, because typing systems and encryption systems were more complex and harder to use. Back then, you had ambassadors not wanting to use top secret cables so much, which requires sending, in most cases, a pouch with a diplomatic courier back to Washington, but instead pushing material down into the lower classifications for the sake of convenience.
Shall we take a couple, maybe a couple of more questions? There's one in the back. Yes, sorry, I think I'll go over to you for earlier.
Thank you. Alice Holstein with Free Speech Radio News. Do you think the prosecution of Bradley Manning and other whistleblowers has had a chilling effect on new leaks of current government actions, and that's why the most recent publications have been more historical in nature?
Julian?
No, not to the degree where people have stopped doing such things, but we, for us, but we have heard about in a quite important investigation recently done by a combined team involving the BBC and the Guardian on Colonel James Steele, who was involved in the El Salvadorization of Iraq. That is, taking the technique for paramilitaries that was used in El Salvador, CIDFs they're called, and putting them into Iraq, something that really kicked off the Sunni-Shia religious ethnic civil war. And James Steele, it was reported by BBC and Guardian, was involved in setting up maintaining or running Iraqi interrogation centres, which involved torture. So as part of that investigation, they tried to speak to a number of former or current US military personnel. And they say in their article that the personnel did not want to speak and used the example of Bradley Manning as why they didn't want to communicate with the press.
Thank you for the opportunity again. This is Munzer Sleiman. You mentioned 1975 in Egypt, something related to the Muslim Brotherhood in universities.
Yes.
Can you clarify more? Is that a connected activity with U.S. diplomats or U.S. embassy, or this is coordinated with the Egyptian government? And taking into consideration the Muslim Brotherhood ascending to powers now in many Arab countries after the so-called Arab Springs, there is any more information about the old relation or long relationship between United States and the Muslim Brotherhood in the documents?
I encourage you to read the story in El Masri Al Yum. It's come out this morning, which goes into further detail. I don't have other details other than the ones that I just gave you. If you go to twitter.com/WikiLeaks, you can see we're tweeting a number of these headlines, including the one from El Masri. Sometimes we also will put out a translation of that story. Speaking in general terms, it's my experience after studying many thousands of U.S. diplomatic cables that the United States makes a priority gaining influence and contacts and informants within opposition movements. Partly in order to corrupt them, partly in order to have bets on both the lead horse and the second, in case there's a transition of power. That's clearly the case, for example, in the Australian Labor Party, that the State Department was particularly interested in developing contacts with Australian Labor Party members, union members, and not so interested in the Conservative Party, who they view to already essentially be on side. It's perhaps a matter of keep your friends close and keep your enemies even closer.
Julian Assange and Kristen Huffington of WikiLeaks announcing the Public Library of U.S. Diplomacy, available online at WikiLeaks.org. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, and that concludes today's program, which was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson. We welcome your comments with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
The higher you build your barriers, the taller I become. The farther you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away. No matter, 'cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone, but no, there's something inside so strong. My voice, the louder I will sing. You hide behind walls of Jericho, our lies will come tumbling. Something inside so strong, so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone, oh no. Something inside so strong, sisters, when they insist we're just not good enough, well, we know better, just look them in the eyes and say, we're gonna do it anyway, we're gonna do it anyway. Something inside so strong, and I know that I can make it. You're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone, oh no. There's something inside so strong.
Inside so strong. something inside so strong.